This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. The local food movement has taken hold here in southeastern Massachusetts and around the country. There are many things to recommend locally grown food. It's likely to be fresher than what you'd find in the grocery store, for one. Farmers markets may have more organically grown produce or heirloom varieties. And knowing the people who grow your food is a value added for many locavores. Others have argued, though, that globalized food production is more efficient and shares the economic benefits of American consumption with third world farmers. Then, of course, there's the fact that farmland comes at the expense of other types of land use, including homes and forests. And not everybody can make the weekly farmers market work with their schedule. So the question is this: where is the balance point? In just a few minutes, we'll talk with Brian Donahue, an associate professor of American Environmental Studies at Brandeis University, about his New England food vision. And later this hour, we'll check in with two environmental activists who blocked a coal shipment headed for New England's largest fossil fuel burning power plant. They were arraigned on 4 criminal charges, including conspiracy, and faced up to 2 years in jail. But on the day the trial was due to start, spoiler alert here, the district attorney who was prosecuting the case dropped the charges and made a rather surprising statement about the seriousness of climate change. We'll hear from the two men who were the lobster boat blockaders. We'll hear why they did what they did and how they're handling the surprise ending to their case, which is gaining national attention. But now, environmental historian Brian Donahue has a vision for New England in which we produce at least half our own food, while still leaving 70% of the region forested. Sound too good to be true? Donahue is the lead author of a newly released New England Food Vision, and he joins me now from a studio at WGBH in Boston. Brian Donahue, welcome to Living Lab.
Good morning, Heather. Thanks for having me on.
We invite you to join our conversation as well. Do you prefer to eat locally produced food? Why or why not? Our toll-free phone number is 866-999-4626. You can send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org, or you can find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Now, Brian Donahue, the document that you've released is called The New England Food Vision. Your co-author, Tom Kelly, of the University of New Hampshire, in the preface calls it a story. But I'm not hearing the words report or study. So how much of this is simply a concept, and how much is based on research and data, and what kinds of data go into this?
Well, in a way, it's a bringing together, a synthesis of what a lot of people have been working on and saying about local food in New England for a long time. So it has those kinds of aspects of trying to include all of the components that go into a vision like this, such as food justice and healthy eating and sustainable production of our fisheries and our farmland. But there is actually quite a bit of fresh research in this as well, because we did some pretty elaborate calculations to try to figure out, you know, how much acreage it requires to feed 15 million people or so who live in New England for various types of food, to get at what might be the best use of the farmland that we have or farmland that we might clear. So in that sense, we did quite a bit of fresh work.
So you call for New England producing at least half of mm-hmm. the region's food locally here. Why not all? Why not none? Why that half?
Right. Well, we don't exactly call for that, although I personally would like to see us move in that direction. We're trying to look at what is possible, what is plausible. It doesn't seem to us that there's enough farmland in New England to produce all of our food, and it may not be such a great thing to produce all of your food locally. I mean, I'm an agricultural historian, and in the past, when all food was grown locally centuries ago, every now and then you had famines. So there's something to be said for being tied into a global food market as well. And there are foods from all over the world that many of us enjoy.
Right. We wouldn't have bananas if we were an all local.
Right. We wouldn't have orange juice and coffee. And you don't really want to start off your vision for the future by saying to folks, hey, you know, come join us in our local food future. No orange juice, no coffee. I don't think that's the sort of thing we want to be trying to push. On the other hand, there's a lot to be said for increased local production of certain foods and for getting people more involved in agriculture. So we were looking for what might make sense in a region like New England, which today has very little farmland. Only about 5% of New England is farmland. 80% is forested. And so if we're going to proposed that we ought to find more farmland in cities and suburbs. We get a little bit that way. But pretty soon, if you want to grow more local food, more regional food, we looked at all six New England states as a kind of a unit, you're going to have to start clearing forest again, which is something we did in our past. And you're going to have to ask yourself, what are the values of forest and how much forest do we think we could clear? What kind of farmland would that be? There's not a lot of great cropland in New England, but there's some pretty good pasture land. So it was an exercise in trying to look at what was possible if we really want to have more local food.
How would we accomplish this, producing half of our own food? I mean, what would the landscape look like? How different? How much more farmland would we need beyond the 5% that we currently have?
Well, if we got to 50% or so, more of New England, especially the central part of New England, would look a little more like Vermont and a little less like New Hampshire and southern Maine do today, where it's heavily grown back to forest. Vermont's a little bit more open. There's maybe 20%, 25% farmland in Vermont, more like 10% in Maine and New Hampshire. So we looked at a tripling farmland just as a potential that would get us to 15% of New England, and that would allow us to grow quite a bit more food, obviously, a little more than three times as much because we reconfigured the kinds of foods we might want to be growing there. We could also find, well, so that, just to give you some numbers, that would take us from 2 million acres of cropland to something like 6 million acres. So that was the number we were working with. Now, again, we're not urging people to grab their chainsaws and rush out and start clearing farmland right off the bat. There's lots we can do with finding pieces of land that aren't being used as intensively right now. This is not a sort of a step-by-step plan. This is, again, more of a sort of a long-term vision.
What is the time scale for this? You actually, in the New England Food Vision, say we could be doing this by 2060. Does that seem fast? Does that seem like we could actually accomplish it before then, potentially?
Well, it's kind of a weasel number. I mean, we picked a time 50 years in the future that's going to be within the lifetime of some of us, certainly of my children, I hope. But it's far enough away that we're not trying to predict what's going to be happening decade by decade. We do get to some policy questions that might help move us in this direction. We also use that number because I was involved previously with a group of scholars, primarily at Harvard Forest, but throughout New England, who did a study and released a vision for the future of the New England forest. And in that one, it was called Wildlands and Woodlands, and David Foster at Harvard Forest was the lead author, and some of us from around the region who've also been involved in forest issues. And we sort of said, look, it's great that we got all this forest back. I mean, New England used to be something like 75% cleared in the 19th century. Now we're 80% forested. We don't want to lose that. And so in that vision, which came out in 2010, we used the year 2060, and we said if we work at it, we could end up with a landscape that's 70% forest covered and protected forest, most of it sustainably managed, some of it in large wild reserves. So get that balance between wildlands and woodlands. And at the same time, we said that would still leave some room for some expansion of agriculture that might serve some of the same kinds of environmental and social ends. So this report or vision that we did with another group of scholars who work more on food issues was to sort of try to fill that gap. And that's where the year 2060 came from. It's sort of an arbitrary year. Who knows if things will move more rapidly in that direction or more slowly. There's a lot of factors that could influence that.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with Brian Donahue, Associate Professor of American Environmental Studies at Brandeis University and lead author of A New England Food Vision. Brian Donahue, you mentioned some of the different values that went into shaping this vision and thinking about being able to produce more of our own food locally. And one that I found really surprising was the fact that 10 to 15% of New Englanders regularly go without enough food. How would this vision address the hunger problem in New England?
That's such a great question. And, you know, So far, most locally and regionally produced food, or a lot of it, is a sort of a niche market. And I've been involved in that all my life. I've been a farmer since the 1970s, growing fruits and vegetables for a long time in the suburbs of Boston, sending some of it into the city of Boston so it would be available to more than just the wealthy. And I guess our dairy in New England, we produce about half our own dairy products, so that goes to a broad market. But ultimately, we can only expand this kind of local and regional production if it's available to everyone, if the demand increases. And we're confident that given a choice and the opportunity and the means, that most people would like to buy high quality food and would work on improving their diets over time. So we did, to do our calculations, we based it on the idea of everyone in New England eating a kind of generically sound diet as recommended today by USDA, to make the calculation of how much food that would take. But at the same time, that's a means of calculation, but it's also an aspiration. It's an important goal that that everyone have access to this kind of food. And that means that society, one way or another, has to reckon that the good health of our people is worth a lot and that we ought to invest in that. And the authors of this report, Molly Anderson and others who work on this, Joanne Burke at the University of New Hampshire, who work on these issues, wrote the sections that really stress that if we can't get this food to everyone, we haven't really succeeded, and that we need more support for people to be able to buy good food.
When you talk about the amounts of land that would be necessary, so looking at 15% of New England's land for farming to accomplish this vision, mm-hmm. 70% remains forested. So that leaves 15% for everything else. How does that compare to where we are now? Does that leave any room for growth?
It does. It does indeed. As nearly as we can figure, something like 5% of New England was developed in 1945, when we had about the same amount of farmland at that time as we're looking for in this vision. Today, something on the order of 10% of New England is developed land. It depends how you count it. I mean, what's developed, what isn't developed, but it's in that range. So if you think that over the past more than half century, 70 years, we've increased from 5 to 10%, we have room in these calculations for several more percent growth and development, and we need development in rural areas. We have parts of rural America and rural New England that have lost population, that need economic growth, that need to build housing. We need affordable housing throughout our society. So I think what you're getting at, though, is that embedded in both of these visions, the forest vision and the food vision, is the idea that the growth that we have in the future ought to be more compact, what people call smart growth. That we redevelop our cities and suburbs in green ways so they're healthier, more attractive places to live in. And there's been a lot of movement certainly in that direction in my lifetime. And that what rural development we have is done carefully and clustered around villages, much like New England was in the past, and not sprawling out so that we can protect as much forest land as possible and also have access to more farmland. So there is another big important component of all this thinking that has to do with the way we grow and the kinds of transportation and energy systems we have and how we provide housing and so forth.
That's environmental historian Brian Donahue of Brandeis University. We're talking about his New England food vision, which calls for at least half of our food to be produced locally by 2060. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Brian Donahue, an associate professor of American Environmental Studies at Brandeis University, about his recently released New England Food Vision. We'd also like to hear from you. Call us toll-free at 866-999-4626. Send email to livinglabradio@capeandislands.org or find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. Tell us what you're willing to do to get your hands and teeth on local food, or why you choose not to. Brian Donahue, we were talking a little bit about the values behind this, things like sustainability, smart growth, addressing hunger, increasing public health through a healthier diet with more vegetables. How much consensus is there around these sorts of values to actually move in this direction in New England?
I think there's pretty broad consensus around them among people who work in the food system, if you will, among people who work on agriculture and sustainable agriculture and fishing and on food issues in general. I think there's a growing realization that we have to find ways of moving on all these fronts. At the same time, all of us who've been doing this for a long time are, you know, we're not naive. We know this is very difficult to make progress on these things. I mean, it's very easy to say everyone should have access to fresh local food. What you're maybe saying when you're saying that is everyone should enjoy a living wage. We are saying that. Well, that's a much larger societal problem than just food. So there's no magic wand that can be waved to make all this happen. We have to tackle some really difficult dilemmas. We have most of our farming and fishing communities for decades, for most of a century, have found it very difficult to make a decent living. So right now, farmers aren't making enough money. So we're not really looking to make food cheaper. We're probably looking to make food more expensive. So that, there's a gap there between that ideal and the ideal of trying to see that everyone can enjoy such food. And indeed, in the last several decades in this country, we've been moving away from supporting people in having access to food. That's been the political tenor of the changes in our country since the Reagan Revolution. So this is a document that's cognizant of all those dilemmas and a kind of a rallying cry for people who are concerned about these things to keep working on it and look at what could be accomplished. If the healthcare industry, for example, has to pick up more and more costs of people who haven't been eating as well as they could for all their lives, they may see it in their interest to help support access to good food as a vegetable prescription, for example, or we're beginning to see. So there are ways, governmental ways, other ways of shifting the way we support agriculture by seeing it as part of this larger system of the way we eat.
Who is your audience for this vision, and what are you doing to make sure that it gets in front of the people who you want to see it?
Well, I guess there's several audiences. One is it's just a way of writing something that expresses the vision of many of the people who work on this. And there's certainly a lot of them in organizations and farmers and fishermen and so forth around New England. And we meet and discuss and work on these things. So it's when you do this kind of work, it's nice to have something that you can look to that says, yes, this is the sort of thing that we would like to achieve and this is what we're working for. And then beyond that, the most important audience, which overlaps with that one, is policymakers. To look at a document and say, here's something that we need to work on at the policy level. And all of the New England states are involved in stakeholder processes to come up with food plans and food policy plans over the next 10 years or so. Vermont has their farm-to-plate plan. Maine is working on that. Massachusetts has the Massachusetts Food Policy Council that's now working on such a plan. The commissioners of agriculture are very involved in thinking about this. We did the Massachusetts launch of the Food Vision yesterday at the Boston Local Food Festival. It was a great day. And, you know, Greg Watson, our commissioner of agriculture, was there to speak to this. This gives them a tool to go to legislators and say, look, here's the sorts of things that we'd like to achieve and here are the kind of policies that we need. They're very excited about this in Maine because this suggests some major economic growth in rural Maine to be one of the important food baskets of New England. So there's an audience there among policymakers. But then the largest one is what you and I are doing now, Heather, which is to get the word out to people in general that local food, regional food is nice, but it can be more than that. It can be part of a generally more environmentally and socially sound way of treating the world.
This is obviously accomplishing this vision would require more than simply policy shifts. This is going to require action on the part of pretty much every individual in terms of changing our diet for most of us from what it is now to something that is based more on fresh, unprocessed foods, and potentially even a different way of getting our food. So how much action would be needed by individual consumers?
Well, what individual consumers can do is great. And, you know, most Americans have large enough incomes to afford to put some more money into food if they chose to do so. Not everyone does. The USDA My Plate recommends we eat virtually twice as many vegetables as we do now, almost three times as much fruit, less processed grain, more whole grains, all that kind of thing that we've all heard a million times. So our assumption is that over time, people will want to move in that direction and will take opportunities to do so. And the American diet has changed in the past. I know that as an historian. And so we think that with a combination of people's individual desire to move in that direction and increasing educational efforts and efforts to support people moving in that direction at the societal level, that we can get there. I mean, I think we don't want to look at this simply as a matter of individual choice, but more of a matter of what kinds of food we support. The sorts of foods that we consume today, the massive amounts of processed carbohydrates and sugars and so forth, are heavily backed by a lot of investment and money, both at the level of private industry, you know, who sell these things, and also at the level of government who help subsidize that kind of production. So it's partly a matter of individual choice, and we're not telling anyone how to eat. We're saying if these opportunities exist and there's access to this kind of food, we think people will gradually over time move in that direction.
How would you create access to this kind of food? At the moment, it's primarily through farmers markets, which, as I mentioned, not everybody can make it to a farmer's market. So how would you try to get local food to everybody?
Well, it has to move into the mainstream, and to some extent, as you say, it has. So, yeah, there could be more farmers markets and co-ops and means of local distribution. But mainly we're talking about food that's produced within the region, going through the food system, distribution system, in ways that are very similar to the way that it does today. There's different possibilities of how to change that, but, you know, I don't think that's not the most important transformation that we're talking about here.
We tend to have fairly large backyards in a lot of Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. It's suburban or fairly rural. What role could home gardens, I think we've seen a resurgence in backyard gardens essentially in recent years. What role could they play in factoring into this larger land use vision?
Oh, an enormous role. And that's great stuff. And, you know, we've certainly had a garden all of our lives and been involved in community farming as well. There's lots of ways to utilize our yards, vacant lots around us, unused fields in the suburbs. We reckon, I should say that it's very hard to figure out how much of that kind of gardening is out there and whether there's been a resurgence or not and how much food is being produced, and no one really keeps track of it. We assume it's a significant amount, not just for the food, but for the kind of engagement that people have with growing their own food and with their neighbors in a community garden or a community farm within their town or neighborhood in the city. All those are enormous social benefits. So that's a huge part of this. In terms of sheer acreage, out of the several million acres that this vision would encompass, that might be a few hundred thousand acres that we're talking about in these small pieces in urban and suburban areas. That greatly increases the quality of life. And, you know, this is where I've worked most of my life. So it's great stuff. But it can't, on the other hand, it can't do all of it. The idea that we could produce all of our food in our cities and suburbs, is not plausible to me. That's not going to produce our dairy products and our grain and most of our meat. And those are big acreage numbers. And so what this vision does is try to say, okay, you know, vegetable production, some fruit production, maybe some backyard chickens, all that sort of stuff makes sense. And that's an important component in urban and suburban areas. But on the other hand, there's need to expand pasturage in more rural areas and get more of our dairy and beef cattle onto grass, which is healthier for them and healthier for us. So it's that kind of balance of looking across the whole landscape from urban to rural areas. And if you go to the website and just Google New England Food Vision and look at this or get a hold of one of the booklets, you'll see the front cover has some kids in Portland, Maine who are, you know, have been part of growing some basil there through Cultivating Community, an organization up there. And then you turn it over and the back cover is a herd of dairy cattle way up in Aroostook County returning to the barn on a rainy day in the fall. So we're trying to look across the whole landscape and think about what kind of food would be produced where and how it would all fit together.
What impact could climate change have on this vision as we see changes in our precipitation regime and in our temperature regime? How would that affect our ability to produce our own food sustainably and reliably?
We don't really know, of course, and it's already had an impact. When I started farming in the 70s, you know, growing 25 acres of vegetables out in the suburbs on the community farm, Landsake, out in Weston. Geez, you know, we didn't dare plant tomatoes before Memorial Day until we started using some of those slitted row covers. But even then, we gained a week or two, and we usually lost the tomatoes pretty early in September. Well, we don't see frost in September to speak of anymore in southern New England, southeastern New England, and we've gained a couple weeks into early May in the spring. So already we have a longer growing season. So in an odd way, for a place like New England, especially when the big issue is growing vegetables year-round or extending the seasons, and when you're talking about putting dairy cows and beef cattle onto grass and you want to extend the grazing season, some of global change may indeed make it easier to grow food in New England and harder in other parts of our country. I mean, I'm not a fan of global warming, obviously, but there may be a good side, if you will, to in terms of our ability to grow more food here. On the other hand, we expect and have seen more extreme events, more floods, you know, so that plays havoc with farming. It can wreck good farmland. It's hard to deal with very rainy years and then very dry years. And warmer, moister climate has already shown us some new pest problems. We're having late blight in potatoes and tomatoes, and that used to be a problem that cropped up very late in the season in your potato crop maybe. But today, in the last few years, it's been devastating tomato crops, particularly for organic farmers across New England. So there's a big downside there. And I guess what we're saying is, okay, we need to make our agriculture in this part of the world and everywhere more diverse, more resilient, have multiple ways of growing these things, not just huge monocultures in, you know, particular parts of the world supplying all the food and shipping it everywhere. We need kind of more resiliency in the system. So that's an important part of this vision.
Brian Donahue, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Brian Donahue is an associate professor of American Environmental Studies at Brandeis University and lead author of New England Food Vision. You can find a link to that document on our website, capeandislands.org. You'll find Living Lab in the program menu. And thanks to John Parker for production assistance with this conversation. Next up, two men who blocked a coal shipment to New England's largest fossil fuel burning power plant talk about why they did it and the surprise outcome of their trial that's grabbing national attention. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. More after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. On a sunny May morning back in 2013, Jay O'Hara and Ken Ward used a 32-foot lobster boat, plus a 200-pound anchor, to prevent a barge from delivering 40,000 tons of coal to New England's largest fossil fuel-burning power plant, the Brayton Point Power Station in Somerset, Massachusetts. The two were subsequently arraigned on four criminal charges, including conspiracy and negligent operation of a motor vehicle, and they were due to go to trial last Monday. They weren't planning to dispute the facts. Instead, they planned to argue that the government's failure to address climate change justified their actions. It's known as a necessity defense, and it would have been the first time a climate-related necessity defense had gone to trial. But Bristol County District Attorney Sam Sutter didn't think Ward and O'Hara would be able to meet the legal standard for a necessity defense. Still, he sympathized with their argument, so he took matters into his own hands. The morning the trial was due to get underway, he announced that he was dismissing the conspiracy charge, downgrading the remaining three charges to civil infractions. He then left the courthouse waving a copy of an article by Bill McKibben, the environmental author and founder of 350.org. And on the courthouse steps, he declared climate change, quote, one of the greatest crises our planet has ever faced. And he said this of his decision.
The political leadership on this issue has been gravely lacking. I am heartened that we were able to forge an agreement that both parties were pleased with and that appeared to satisfy the police and those here in sympathy with the individuals who were charged. I am also extremely pleased that we were able to reach an agreement that symbolizes our commitment at the Bristol County District Attorney's Office to take a leadership role on this issue.
Amen.
I spoke with the defendants, Ken Ward and Jay O'Hara, the day after the trial was called off. I asked them whether congratulations were in order.
Maybe it's not congratulations, but at least attaboy. You know, it's kind of a strange, unexpected position to be in where the person who is prosecuting you all of a sudden is standing out in front of the courthouse saying essentially we need to do direct action and civil disobedience because the climate issue is not at the forefront of our political discussion.
Are you at all disappointed that the trial didn't go forward? I mean, this was slated to be a bit of a show trial with some very high-profile people testifying on your behalf.
Well, I think so on one level, but this is really kind of an extraordinary event to have the DA Sutter take the stance that he did. And so it's really hard to compare the two. It's sort of an apples and oranges thing. I think that probably the thing that we would say we're disappointed is that the plant is still burning coal. But as a matter of politics, this is really an important step to have a prosecutor say this is civil disobedience, needs to be treated as civil disobedience, and is appropriate civil disobedience.
Brayton Point Power Station is slated to close in 2017. They announced earlier this year that they are planning to close that power plant. I take it that's not soon enough for you.
No. I mean, we need to take the obvious steps. And the very first of those steps, the one that Dr. James Hansen lays out, and he's the person we think you should turn to when you're looking for, well, what should we be doing here? Very first step is to stop burning coal. And that's what we need to do.
But Dr. Hansen has laid out essentially that globally we need to stop burning coal by 2030 entirely. And if we have any hope and expectation of being able to accomplish that, states like Massachusetts and countries like the United States have to stand up and take moral leadership and start doing this now. Because if we, you know, go along essentially with the Obama administration's regulations, we're going to be nowhere by 2030.
How did you two meet and decide to take this action to drive a lobster boat into the path of a coal barge headed for Brayton Point Power Station?
We thought about it independently. We knew each other. We had met each other in rallies and a sleep out on the Boston Commons over climate a few years before this action. I had thought that, well, it's really time to do this kind of thing for several different reasons. And Brayton Point was the obvious place to focus because it's such a giant, visible plant, largest coal emitter in New England. And I wanted to find somebody else to do it. And I spent, I don't know, a couple months talking to people, and as I ran across them in normal life and in activist circles. And then I went down to the Boston City Plaza where a number of people were doing were sleeping out to call on the Senate candidates, U.S. Senate candidates, to address climate. It was the night that Hurricane Sandy is actually starting to come into Boston, so it was a pretty dramatic night with rains and wind slashing in. I went down about 3 o'clock because I thought they were kind of be wet and cold, and I brought some hot cider. And Jay was there. I didn't expect him to be there, and I said, hey, I got this idea of something we might be done at Brayton Point with a boat, and he said, great, let's do it.
Ken doesn't seem to mention this very often, but Ken has been a leading environmentalist and head of of several organizations, including a deputy director at Greenpeace USA for a time, and he spent a lot of time thinking about what the environmental movement strategy needs to be on something as large as climate, and that the typical way of doing things just has not worked. I come from a little bit of a different background, which is a religious background. I'm a committed life Quaker, and for me that means trying to live with integrity every part of my life with the truth as I understand it, and certainly truth as revealed through the scientific method as a valuable way to understand truth. And given the truth that we understand, how am I supposed to live my life out? And I've been thinking for some time about that it's time to step up our game and put our lives where our mouths are. And I grew up on Cape Cod. Fall River is the closest plant. Brayton Point is the closest coal plant to me. A lot of the emissions drift downwind to where we are. And when Ken came to Government Center that night on the eve of Hurricane Sandy and brought us some hot cider, it was just a real opening. It was really clear that this was the work that was mine to do and that we were there to do it together.
Can you describe exactly what you did on that morning of May 15th?
Yeah, we awoke really early in Newport, Rhode Island, and after a brief short prayer meeting with our friend Marla on the docks in Newport, we got underway under a cloudless sky on a windless day and motored north through Narragansett Bay, being able to see online, actually track this shipment of coal on the Energy Enterprise that was coming up from the docks in Norfolk, Virginia. Knowing that it was going to arrive later that day, we anchored our boat in the ship channel in front of this giant pier and this giant power plant and this giant pile of coal in Somerset, dropped anchor and awaited for the ship to arrive and also evidently for the authorities to come too. And there was the Coast Guard who responded first and was there with us and boarded our boat and was on our boat for about 7 hours while they figured out how to deal with us.
Part of figuring out how to deal with it was the fact that you hadn't just dropped any anchor. You had dropped a 200-pound anchor. That doesn't come back up easily.
That's true. We did drop a very large anchor, which was essentially chained to the keel of the boat. So we were trying to make ourselves immovable. And we had positioned the boat in such a way that the coal ship actually docked somewhat safely, and there was not a hazard to navigation, but was able to dock safely, just not in a way that they could unload their coal. And there we kind of had the bow of our boats pointed at each other for 5 or 6 hours.
You were in a 32-foot lobster boat, and these coal barges are enormous, 40,000 tons of coal. Did you ever fear for your life?
Well, I will say there was a moment when I was watching this giant self-unloading tanker come towards us and not appear to be slowing down, when we thought, well, it would be pretty easy to swamp us here. But it was pretty clear that that's not. I mean, the tanker was being brought in under the control of three tugs, and the Coast Guard was there, and it was all quite safe and choreographed. It's just, it's a big ship when you're looking up at it. So there was a moment or two.
I'd say the most dramatic part of it was even before the ship arrived. Ken and I were sitting on the transom of the lobster boat, kind of in plain view to assure everyone that we were not a threatening presence, that we were doing a peaceful protest. And over our shoulders, we heard the unmistakable bolt action of a rifle being cocked by the Somerset police. And that was certainly sends a chill up your spine. We were being very cooperative. We had called them to inform them what we were up to and had been very clear that we weren't a threatening presence to anybody. But that certainly was a hair-raising moment.
Let me ask you about the lobster boat. Was there a symbolism in the choice of that particular type of vessel as opposed to, say, a sailboat?
Well, I'd say they just ended up that we ended up with having a lobster boat. Found this great lobster boat. It looked beautiful. Ken and I both love old wooden boats. So that it was a natural choice. I think the biggest symbolic part of the whole thing was we named the boat the Henry David T after Henry David Thoreau, who spent a lot of time thinking and writing about how, given what we know, how are we supposed to act when there are big changes that need to be made?
I guess for me, seeing the lobster boat in part evoked just how profound some of the shifts going on in New England's waters are as a result of climate change. It seemed to have an added layer of connectedness to the New England situation in particular.
Yeah, we didn't plan this, but man, it was good. I mean, you know, the picture, the pictures, the scale, that kind of evocation of a New England that we've lost or losing. The only thing I contributed consciously to this symbolism was to make sure we had an American flag on board. I feel like there's been something of a slippage of it's all of our flags, and we felt we were doing a basic protest in the classic American tradition from the Tea Party on. And we ought to say that, which was easiest to do by flying a flag.
Ken, as Jay alluded to earlier, you have been involved in the environmental movement much of your career. You were deputy director of Greenpeace for a time, and this action has been compared to some of the early Greenpeace actions. What, in your mind, was so different about what you two did blockading this coal shipment as opposed to other climate protests that we've seen in recent years?
Well, I was definitely inspired by the Greenpeace traditions of direct action. What's different about this is that, first of all, it was a direct action, not just a symbolic protest. And a direct action means trying to put yourself, your body, at the point of the insult or the injury and prevent it. So we were literally placing ourselves between the coal tanker and the pier. And it's different than from just a symbolic protest that's at a government site or even just holding a placard somewhere. I should say that we had support and assistance from Greenpeace US in the planning of this, which was a great help to us. We didn't have a lot of support. In fact, we had a lot of criticism from within the environmental community when we proposed to do this.
So what was that criticism?
Well, there were a number of organizations that thought that this would complicate rather than expand climate efforts in general, and specifically the efforts to shut down Brayton Point.
And do you feel that's a symptom of the environmental movement becoming too timid?
I think part of the problem that we face is that the environmental movement isn't treating climate appropriately and is way too bound up in the business of politics as usual. And in fact, one of the most interesting things about what happened is we have a Bristol County district attorney who is like a lot of us and a lot of our institutions and all of our environmental groups is faced with the problem of how do you integrate a problem that's bigger than normal life and normal day-to-day politics and work? How do you balance those two? Well, he found some way to do that.
You have a 13-year-old son. I'm curious what his response to this whole, the action and the charges, the trial, the prospect of jail time. What has his response to this been?
He's 14 now. I've talked to him twice since coming back out here. The first thing he said was, geez, really don't want you to go to jail. And I said, oh, thanks for your concern. And he said, well, yeah, I'm concerned about you, but I don't want my friends to know that my dad's in jail. I was like, oh, well, that's okay. But I talked to him this morning, and he said, hey, I hear you're famous. he read the New York Times. So I think to see your dad quoted in the New York Times is, he was kind of proud of that.
Does he share your concern about climate change and the future into which he's growing up?
Well, my experience of not so much talking to Eli as listening to Eli and his friends talk. I mean, I think we've got a generation that's got an underlying sense of things being terribly wrong. They don't really necessarily know. They can talk about climate. They know what the information is. But it's more of a sense, and it's very sad, I think, to listen to this sense that something's going amiss, before they're even grown up. And I think it's very painful. And it's certainly one of the things that, I do this for a lot of reasons, but I very much do it. And at any point where I'm faced with something difficult or scary, it's pretty easy for me to go, well, I want to make sure that for my boy that I have tried everything I can think of. I don't want to have come up with something, well, here's something we could have done, and I don't do it.
In my generation, I'm 32, and so I guess I'm at the older end of the millennials. Almost all of my peers have that same underlying sense of something is desperately wrong, but we're all struggling to find what our point of agency in this is. What is where is it that our daily lives can meet the enormity of this crisis? And it's a crisis not just of the physical nature of the planet, but of the fact that our political and economic systems aren't equipped to deal with the problem of this magnitude. Well, if that's the case, how am I supposed to live my life? And we don't have easy answers yet. And part of the problem, I think, is that we don't yet have a set of leadership in the environmental movement or in the political sphere that shows with their lives committed on the line what that life should be and look like.
Jay, when you and I met a few years ago, you were bicycling everywhere. What does your daily life look like at this point?
In general, my daily life is, and this is a long-standing Quaker tradition, a long-standing tradition in a lot of faith traditions, that in order to focus on what is most important, we need to clear away the clutter and free our lives to follow where we are led. And so for me, I work part-time as a sailmaker, a job which is pleasurable and enjoyable, working with my hands on a day-to-day basis, but have simplified my life to the point where I only need to do that part-time so that the rest of my life is free to pursue the really important work that we're free to pursue. I'm not yet ready to crucify myself on the hypocrisy of whether or not I occasionally ride in cars or drive cars. I don't own one at this point. I tend to take the bus or ride a bike or sail where I'm going. I live on a sailboat in the summer. And my partner and I, Meg, sailed to the trial. But for me, the spiritual discipline comes back to kind of one of my guiding principles. It comes from a poem by Mary Oliver called Wild Geese, in which she says, you do not have to be good. You do not have to crawl on your knees through the desert for 100 miles repenting. You simply have to love what the soft animal of your body loves. And for me, that kind of giving over, that confessional nature of a life trying to align with what we know deeply in our hearts to be true regardless is at the center. And I can't allow myself to get hung up necessarily on the day-to-day. I have to keep my focus, as the civil rights movement said, keep my eye on the prize.
Jay O'Hara, Ken Ward, attaboy, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Heather.
District Attorney Sutter has been careful to say that any precedent set by Ward and O'Hara's case would be limited to extremely similar situations within Bristol County. Of course, the two contend that clears the way for others to disrupt operations at Brayton Point Power Station, precisely as they did. The two say they're planning to start a climate disobedience center to help others navigate the complexities of planning just such acts of protest. And that's our show for today. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab On The Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw through the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.